we can't ask the old questions over. You know, we can't do it the old way. We have to find out. I think it's going to call for another way of dealing with things. And so this is just kind of a, I just have a half a dozen words that describe it, what it is. I put down some things I wondered about. Let me just run those by you first to kind of lead into it. I wonder about the interconnectedness of what we see falling away as well as becoming new. We see some things, come on in, we just start talking. For example, what's happening to the family arrangement? You know, you wonder about that in terms of, we think that is sort of a basic unit of society. So we see a lot of separations taking place between people. In some states, it's up to 50%, 60% of the marriages are falling apart, for example. Then we also see other attempts at new formations of kinds of arrangement of interdependence. Sometimes people enter into a one-on-one thing and they go off and establish the same thing over again, but it's with a different person. Sometimes you wonder about the basis for all of that to happen. So we see some things dropping, some things becoming new, and it's hard to tell which one's good and which one's bad because of our own value system gets all mixed up in them. We see the stock market take a dive, and when I do, I say, aha, the tip of the iceberg showing again, you know. And I go, yippee, and then I suddenly realize that my pension plan's all invested in the stock market someplace, you know, by the church. And I say, oh, geez, I can't afford that. So, you know, it's that kind of difficult job to differentiate what's falling away. Or I wonder about the connections between struggles in South Africa, Chile, Brazil, the widening gap between the rich and the poor, the disintegration in the family, the male depression syndrome, heightened oppression, new ways to health and healing, new biblical understandings, the nature of matter, reality, space, time, and the gap between the head and the gut that exists between people. Or the wonder about the connect between our intellect and our will and our physical selves. I talked about being separated from ourselves. And what it is that tends to cause the separation to take place. We know a lot of stuff up here, we also know it down here, and there are two different kinds of things going on, and this, and it renders it very often immobile or in conflict with ourselves as we act out. Wonder about the illusions we've labored under and the importance of some kind of disillusionment to take place. How can we be disillusioned? You know, by that I mean, can those illusions under which we live and operate, how can those be lifted from us so we can see more clearly? That includes things that we thought we had settled and cooled or put away in a box and labeled neatly for all time. I think we have to get most of them all back out again, look in the box. It's like, I think labeling is one of the worst things that can happen, and I wonder about those labels. Because labels end any further discussion. And they don't make room for things in between. It's like when somebody a theologian, one of the guys that does theologizing for the American Lutheran Church was talking to him about some of this stuff. And he said, well, that's Gnosticism. Well, what he did was label it, put it in a box, put it on a shelf, and he had dealt with it.
You know? What's Gnosticism?
Oh, it's an early Greek religion that was considered to be a heresy in the church. Or he can just label it a heresy. That's a heresy. You put it in a box and put it on the shelf. Or it's animism, which used to belong. We used to think of as belonging to the heathen when they saw life in rocks and trees and, you know, the Indian lore and all that and all those dumb heathen. And that's animism, and that he doesn't believe in a true and living God, and you can see God in all things. And then they call it pantheism, it could be, in all gods. And I mean, God in everything, pan meaning all, pantheism, God in everything. But I think we have to get a lot of those things that we thought we had cooled and or that we had labeled sin or not sin, you know. sex is sin, we call it, or certain kind of sexual behavior is sin, like the gay issue, you know. Society had dealt with that pretty well. Now it's sticking its head back up out of the box again. So I'm saying that a lot of the things that I think we thought we had cooled and all labeled and stored safely away, we got those dealt with, are going to come off the shelf. And that has to do with the illusions. I think that's been illusory kind of a thing. I wonder about the mystery and all this stuff that I'm talking about, the mystical aspect, what it means for us, how do we get a hold of it, how do we, how open need we be to it, what do we look for, what do we watch for. It's almost though, when I say I'm wondering, I'm really excited, okay, do you sense that? I mean, those kind of wonderments are exciting to me. And I wonder about the role of an institutional church and all those kind of wonderings. You know, what is an institutional church? How's the institutional church going to deal with that? Will it be able to? Will it render itself impotent? You know, I'm not concerned about the church, period. I think that will go on some way, some shape or form, but I'm thinking traditionally now of what we think of as the institutional church. Okay, so when you wonder about all those kinds of things and all that comes back into it, about the best that I could come up to me, at least as a beginning point, would be to have some clarity in my own mind as to what my stance ought to be. You know, how do I, where do I take off from? A stance is usually the position that you take before the action starts. You know, it's preparatory thing. If you're playing golf, you take a golfer stance. If you're playing baseball, you have a batting stance. If you're a catcher, you have a different stance. You know, if you're on a ball team, etc. But it's where you place your feet before you make the shot, kind of. Okay. Take the stroke, whatever. And I'd also suggest that if we take a look at stance, that the chances are we'll find if we take a proper stance, it probably will feel a little awkward at first.
Have you thought of the proper stance? Have you thought of where we should stand?
Well, that's what I've got six words here that describe the stance for me, and I want to say something about each of them. That's what I really want to do now. Okay. But usually when somebody comes to tell me how to hit a golf ball or how I'm supposed to bat or shoot a basketball or pot clay, you hold your hands in, you do this, and it feels very awkward at first, you know. It doesn't feel like it's... but you find out that's what's the best place to be. And so I have a sense that to people who are oriented to action and reaction to all kinds of things may find it especially so to be awkward and this kind of stuff. Okay, the first word that describes the stance, okay, is open. Well, I don't mean we should take an awkward stance. I guess what I'm saying is that proper stance usually tends to feel awkward because we don't very often naturally get into the right stance. You know, that's a suspicion. Yeah, I hate to call it awkward. I mean, I hate to call the stance awkward, but I think it might feel that way for a while at first. You know, once you're into it and become, you watch a good golfer, nothing awkward about, you know, once they start taking a swing or a good batter.
When you first learn to do it, it's very unnatural.
Yeah, it seems to be unnatural, yeah. Simply because we're acculturated to respond different, not function that way. Okay. Okay. The first word's open. Now, by that, I mean it's a readiness to move in any direction. When I played football in college, one of the exercises that we would go through would be to be in an open stance, particularly if you're on defense in an open field, so that we did a lot of moving around, you know. Like this and like this, so that we're ready to go any direction, no matter what happens. And so, by open, I mean we need to have our stance broad and open, ready to move in any directions. It means, at that point, it means to me to be as broadly based as possible, to be open to all kinds of things, always subject to change, and more expected of surprises than not. Okay? And that's really different from where we've generally been. We've really kind of sought after security, So that, but the anticipation of surprises creates another whole. If you're going into a place you haven't been before, even into a dark room, you know, there's all kinds of adrenaline going through your blood, and because you're not sure what you're going to bump into, you can only see some things vaguely and darkly. Or you're going into a cave up here on the side of the mountain, you think it's a mine opening, and you anticipate surprises, so you're very cagey. Okay. It means a willingness to ride with a good amount of ambiguity. Ambiguity means if something's ambiguous, it's very difficult to decide whether it's right or wrong, or not being able to settle it right away. It's rather ambiguous. It's rather undecided. So it means being able, a willingness to ride with a good amount of being willing to deal with things that aren't all decided yet. And there's two or three or four sides to something, or a way of understanding it, or seeing.
Flexibility.
Yeah, it has a lot of flexibility if you're ambiguous. And a lot of people just can't tolerate anything that's ambiguous. They want a yes or no answer, and they want it now, and they want it quick. And that's very often in our culture. I think the people who can help us most with that, as men, are women. Women are better at dealing with that kind of thing than men are very often. Men, the masculine thing in our culture is to zing in on it, nail it down, and wrap it up and pay the price, right or wrong.
Box it, label it, put it away.
Yeah. Box it, put it away. Now, that kind of an open stance, I think, is important because it'll help from being trapped in corners. And if we get trapped in a corner, that gives rise to defensive kind of activity, defensive action, and that tends to diffuse and to divert from the real issues and realities that you're dealing with. You tend to be defending against whatever's happened, you're boxed in, and you're not ready for new input. You're defending your position, you're defending where you're at. And I was trying to, even though I feel very strongly about what I was saying the last couple of mornings, you know, to all of you, I was trying to deal with that with an open stance and not try to be defensive about it. And it's tough not to be able to define quantum. When I've been talking about quantum physics for, you know, off and on for the last couple of days. But that, I don't need to do that. It'll take care of itself. I think you got the message. And so it's try to keep from, stay open so you don't get caught in corners. Sometimes we need to be there, but if it gives rise to this defensiveness, then it's diverting, it's diversionary, and it wastes energy, wastes a lot of energy. We start covering our tail instead. Okay, that's one. One is open, okay? Second word that I use to describe what I think may be helpful is the word visionary. Now, this to me means more than just a dreamy kind of existence. It calls for a kind of active searching and dreaming. Frankly, one of the reasons I like to watch the news at night or find the paper in the morning is because I'm actively dreaming. I'm actually searching. I'm looking. I'm always looking for signs of the iceberg. And I didn't get back to that, but it has to do with what you do while you're doing it, even while you're reading the newspaper. Okay, or you're riding the bus, or you're listening to conversation with a friend, or you're talking to somebody you haven't met before to find out where they're from, what's happened to them, all that sort of thing. So it's kind of an active dreaming and searching, and it means intentional efforts, really trying to balance the rational, you know, the head type thinking that it's rational and has reason, cause and effect kind of thinking, with the intuitive side of oneself. The intuitive side of oneself is the side, the kind of things you know because you know it. Okay, you know it. It's even more than feeling. This again in our culture has been designated as more of a feminine trait than a masculine trait. Masculine traits are thought of as to be intellectual, and the female traits are thought to be intuitive. We both are. All men and women are both of these things, but our culture has sort of made that masculine-feminine distinction. It means redevelopment of parts of our wholeness. that the culture is programmed out of us. The culture forces us, for example, to think certain ways. We get schooled in certain ways. There's the right side and the left side of the brain. And the left side of the brain is the cognitive side, or the intellectual side, the rational side, and the right side of the brain is the intuitive side. And it's amazing how much we exercise only the left side of our brain. We get it programmed out of us. It's the whole business on split brain theory that's been done now. That there are two sides of the brain, that they function that way. So, even by watching a movie, we're being programmed to function on the left side of our brain, because when the electrical impulses that are measurable that come out of the head, they could put the measuring devices to you. They're alpha, beta, gamma, delta kinds of electrical currents and waves that come off the brain. And the slower ones come off of the right side, and the faster ones come off the left side. Okay. When we're thinking, when we're intellectualizing, when we're doing all that, the left side of our brain is overworking. My left side of my brain is working like mad right now. And when we're sleeping, when we're resting, when we're being creative, when we're playing, when we're having fun, it all slows down, and the other side of your brain starts to function. More on the intuitive side. And a lot of it's been, well, when we watch a movie, there were tests made that show that the number of electrical impulses that are given off in a room in a given amount of time will be picked up by your brain, and your brain will function at about the same level. So that if you watch a movie, which is how many frames a second, 16 millimeter, 36 frames a second, something like that. Anyhow, the biggest impact that's going on with you there is not what's happening on the screen or what the play or what the drama or what the people are saying, but that the left side of your brain is being programmed to function intellectually. Okay. That's one of the conclusions that came out of that study. Another example of that is fluorescent lights. Fluorescent lights function at about 132 times per second. That's what you have. And if you sit under those, I have all the fluorescent lights in my office out. I took them out of the ceiling and put a desk lamp on. If I sit under them all day long at my desk, I'm just about to climb the wall by the time the day is over, because my brain is picking up that bzzz, and I'm doing it. I get higher than a kite.
You're in schools.
Yeah, they do. Well, you find it in most business offices. If they really want a good, efficient secretarial staff, thing to do is to put in good fluorescent lights all over the building, and you will function. In fact, Capra, when he was at our lecture, we had fluorescent lights in the room, and he asked that the ones in the front where he was working to be shut off while he talked. He didn't want them on. So, you know, what I'm saying is, it's a long way of saying that we need to redevelop the parts that have been programmed out of us, and they get programmed out of us. Sometimes we know about it, sometimes we don't know about it. But the truth is, we get separated again from yourself. That means also, visionary to me means to function from a place that trusts the religious instincts, or honors and respects the transcendent, the spiritual aspects of reality that you get in touch with. And I don't think we spend enough time doing that. That's usually time that's silent and alone, and just letting it be, not doing anything. You know, and that oftentimes brings stuff in touch with stuff that as soon as you try to get in touch with it, you tend not to be able to do it. I've got a little biofeedback machine up in my room. Maybe I can bring it down at noon. Some of you want to play with it. You can attach it to your fingers, and it'll buzz until you relax to a certain point, and the buzzer goes off, and you can set it up higher, and it'll buzz again. You relax at another level, and you can keep working at relaxing, and you find out that as soon as you try and relax, the buzzer gets louder.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but that's one way to find out what's happening to you. I'll bring it down to lunch. If somebody wants to play with it, they can. I'll help you. It means the contemplative. you know, to be able to spend time in thought, meditation, to be visionary. It might make possible a new stand or new picture of reality. And you can see that new reality of the way things are more like a vision rather than a whole bunch of interconnected events with cause and effect kind of things. You kind of get a sense of where things are rather than, it's sort of like a panoramic view rather than a bing, 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 bing kind of thing. You know, if this happens and that'll happen, that'll happen, that'll happen. And if I can figure out what I can do here that'll make that happen and that'll happen, that'll happen, that'll happen, I can control what the outcome's going to be down here. So we get very wound up in the control factor rather than to kind of get a sense of...
In the process rather than the product.
Yeah, you really have a sense of feeling for the process and to trust the process as it goes. I think, like you, Todd, you know, you're a very creative person, and I think very often, even though you have an idea where you're going to go, you get into a process, and the way you go, and it's from that that the excitement starts, and things begin to work. Okay. Third word, and we'll be halfway through already of these, means to be sensitive. This is the listening part of the stance. Not only the kind of listening to others and listening to your inner self, paying attention to hunches that excite you or energize you. You get a hunch something would be a good idea to do, or you're going to try something. Most of the stuff I do on hunches. Or try new stuff, I'll do on hunches. Why'd you do that? Oh, I say I had a hunch. Most people will buy that. Even people in administrative positions. You say, I had a hunch it was a good place to go or a good thing to do. But it's the kind of listening that bears the nerve ending, so they're very sensitive. You know, it trains us to pick up nuances and subtleties that are going on around us. Again, that has to do with developing a third eye up here or here, wherever you want to put it. Another way of seeing, you kind of shift into that, or else take the blinders off. This kind of sensitivity, I think it's important to be sensitive because it keeps you from drawing simplistic conclusions, saying, you know, oh, that's easy, this is what happened, that's why it's that. You know, things are too integrated, too interwoven to be that simplistic. I do it all the time for shortcuts, but I also know of its, I can't trust that kind of simplistic answer too much. But if we get too simplistic and we aren't sensitive to how things are interrelated and interconnected, even if we don't know how they all work, we tend to disregard the interconnectedness of things. And that again, to me, is a violation of the creation. And we're using the things of God against God. So to be sensitive calls for, then, a holistic approach to all that God's made. Rocks and birds and bees and you and me. Okay, a fourth word is the word vulnerable. And that could be a scary word to a lot of people, that we need to face the future from a stance that's vulnerable. Now, I don't mean to imply that we have a suicide stance, you know, that we're that vulnerable or woundable, that we can be wounded, or to resign ourselves just to foolish abandon, you know, that we're so vulnerable we'll just go do anything, any place, any time. I don't mean to say that. This relates a little bit to openness stance, the openness of the stance, because when you're really open, you're vulnerable too. Okay? It's really strange too, but that's the only way love comes, when you're open. People never make love like that, you know? And so it is. It's to be you're vulnerable. When you make love, you're vulnerable. When you relate to people, you can often see open people when they're in a conversation with somebody, just how they stand or relate. You know, they just stand open. Okay, so to be open means to be open to change. In one's own self or understanding, and that's a part of that open piece that overlaps with the vulnerable. And it seems that the vulnerability thing has a lot to do with making an effective witness. Okay, let me say a little bit about that now. I doubt that a witness from one person to another person about anything ever takes place unless the witness is done from a vulnerable position. Say it again?
Yeah.
Okay. I doubt if an effective witness about anything, or your faith, or whatever, is ever possible if it's not done from a vulnerable position. In other words, if you aren't vulnerable when you make your witness, you know, if you don't open yourself up. Let me say a little more, okay? Usually one witnesses to another person in order to change their mind or to help them understand. E.g., the old Christian witness is, let me witness to you about Jesus or my faith. Okay? And the idea for that so often to me is from a closed stance, from an invulnerable position. The invulnerable position then is one which says, I got it, you don't got it. Sit still long enough so I can witness to you, and it ends up being target practice.
I see that.
You see?
I see that, but I don't see how... I'm not sure if you're vulnerable once you are witnessing of the faith of a Christian.
Okay, well, let me take it a little step further then. The vulnerability comes in. To display and admit a vulnerability when you're witnessing is a way of saying that the struggle is on. It's a way of saying to you, as I witness to you, okay, baby, you know, you hear what I have to say. I'm going to tell you, you know, where I am, what I understand to be, but I'm open, and I'm also saying, tell me where you are.
Mm-hmm.
And the possibility lies, the vulnerability in my witness lies in my ability, I mean, in the possibility that I will be changed. Unless you take that risk from that kind of vulnerable position, you ain't going to change nobody. You might change their head thought pattern, but you're not going to change their guts.
Well, although when you're witnessing Christ, you're hoping that you aren't going to make the change. You're just hoping that you will open their mind and they will question it, and then Jesus will change.
Okay, but you know, don't take that on your back. You know, you just witness. Yes, that's all. But you be open then to hear and to hear the response to what you have to say. I really doubt if anything ever happens unless it's done unless I'm open to hear what somebody else's experience of God may be about. Because
yeah,
like if I understand what God's all about, you don't understand. The assumption behind that is that I really got it straight and you ought to get it from me and I ain't changing. Would you listen to that? Huh? Especially if you had any conviction at all?
But then the other thing is, though, if you come on as a friend, if you say, look at what I have, this is what it is to me, perhaps, you know, is the greatest thing I've ever experienced.
Yeah,
and
okay.
As far as I know, it is the greatest.
Yeah, okay.
You give it a try.
Yeah.
And see what you think.
Yeah, but then if you're not open to hear what I think is the greatest thing in my life,
mm-hmm.
Why should I go do what you want? I say, you try what I think is the greatest, I'll try what you think is the greatest. I think, doesn't necessarily mean it's always got to work that way. But I may be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
May be wrong. But I don't feel, that's what I feel. I don't feel that a witness is effective at all from one person to another unless it's from an invulnerable position.
Yeah, I understand that. I understand
okay.
How we should listen to their side also.
With the possibility that you yourself will be changed.
No.
What did you say? Again?
With the possibility that you yourself might be changed.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not all the way,
mm-hmm.
maybe that much,
oh, I see.
You see.
Okay.
But Otherwise, you got it all in the box.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, as I felt as an example, sort of, time ago they swapped me. Saturday in Prescott. Yeah. A lot of people are there. In a street corner Christian church. They're handing out tracts. And I was walking by, and I had a hand up for me, and I said, "No, thank you." And he automatically turned me and he said, "See, you're already rejecting Christ. You're already become." I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
And right then, I automatically rejected him.
Yeah.
Because he's not budging.
Yeah. No.
Instead of being vulnerable, he's fortifying his position. Like, are you saved? I am. You're not. But I am, so listen to me. And everything you're doing is wrong. So they're not vulnerable at all. They're bulletproof.
That kind of a stance or understanding of who God is or how he reveals himself is a boxed-in stance.
Yeah.
Even when I do it or you do it, if we got God boxed in, I'm going to deliver him in a package. Then I think our God's too small. Okay, now we're not open to the possibility that God's working someplace else in another person in a different way. Because I think we do this as Christians on an international basis to great, huge masses of humanity called Buddhists and Hindus and all those kinds of people, Jews. That's a bigger issue. But I think even there, we have to be vulnerable. If we really believe what we believe in, we don't have to worry about it making it.
Because it's not by us that it's going to make it.
No, we're not going to make it anyhow. So, but it is a kind of vulnerability which, oh my God, I built my whole life on this thing now, and now it's getting shaky because I'm afraid you're going to tell me something that's not right and I don't want to hear it. So listen to me so I can get you like me and that'll support me. So it's vulnerability. But it's an exciting place to be. A lot of people spend all their energy in covering their rear flanks. I mentioned that earlier. Always got to cover your bottom. You know, if you don't turn your back, you're always shifting around. You're always in that corner, you know, or you can't. And I think to be honest or to be upfront with things probably takes less energy and probably in the final analysis may be less vulnerable. So it's kind of a contradiction when I say vulnerable. To be vulnerable may render you less vulnerable to change. Or being changed.
And you might be less noticeable.
Yeah. See, I think because we think we got it all wrapped up, we just simply refuse to see some things. It may not be what you do, but what you do while you're doing it that makes a difference. You can witness or you can witness. One might be using the things of God against God, and another thing might be joining in with God, what God's up to. So that's the whole difference in view. Yes?
Just remember that vulnerability, and particularly the vulnerability that you have when you're witnessing, is a very humble thing, too.
Yes.
Because I know that for myself that I would have the tendency to assume that I've got it straight and that that I've got it right and I've got things settled. And that's not, you know, if you're a Christian, you're always struggling with things.
Yeah.
People are always struggling with things. And that if you can share to the other person that you too are struggling, they'll relate to that. That a person who's struggling will not relate to someone who comes on like a
it's all posies.
Or like a, well, I've got it all settled, you know, questions. That'll scare them off or make them feel even worse.
Yeah. Yeah. Right, I think you're right. Yeah. A vulnerable stance, one last word on that, I think will make a higher level of risk possible. And I think in terms of all of that, that may be a very important part of the struggle for meaning in our existence and purpose. Okay, that's the fourth one. I got two more words. Next one is faithful. This sounds like an old trite phrase, but faith-full, two words. Which maybe gives it a little more meaning. This piece of the stance emphasizes the uniqueness of our religious base. Let me use an illustration that I wrote down here in this descriptive paragraph. In the first two crucial steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, the candidate finds number two perhaps to be the most difficult, and that's this one. We came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Now, that's kind of a toughie. And this one also might be the most difficult one for the socially active Christian. Now, I've always seen myself as a Christian social activist. Okay. To be faithful can help, and John talked about this last night in the odor study, can help lift this overall responsibility from my shoulders, you know, for the whole world. God, I used to take the whole world on, and then not sleep at night because I'm afraid it wouldn't make it if I didn't get everything straight. And if you can lift that weight off your shoulders to a power greater than ourselves, it's like the AA step two, you know, a power greater than ourselves is what's going to help lift us to some kind of sanity. Then I think we're in a better position to go, in a way, you know. It's a way of being able to breathe again, to find some space and find some room. But at the same time, we're not away from where we are. Everybody's got to be someplace up there on the board. We're not away from where we are, and we have the opportunity. It doesn't remove us from our sphere of influence in our local and in our and in the farther reaching also spheres of influence which we may have. Now, it doesn't mean, now let me say what it doesn't mean as well. It doesn't mean to cop out on the social issues or on the global issues. And that's a quick interpretation of that. When I talk about faithful, Wayne would say to me, it's a cop-out. It's a cop-out. But I mention this here to remind us, you know, that we be faithful, that we be reminded that God is a God who is not dead. He's still alive. He's well. He's still present. And he's active in his world, and further, that he's not essentially dependent upon me. He's not essentially upon us for the fulfillment of his good purposes. And what we need to do, let me say it this way. I got a paragraph here that talks about waves. Maybe that'll be a better way to say it. If the waves caused by God's action in the world are in motion, we, it seems, should give some thought to recognizing them, learning how to trust and celebrate them, and riding them or participating in the waves instead of being overwhelmed by them in what could be for us a crushing disaster. You have no control over the wave. It's in motion. You can let it, you know, throw you down, or you can surf it. You know, you can ride it, and it can be very exhilarating. And it doesn't take a lot of the risk out of it at all, kind of a thing. So to be in a faithful stance, to me, would mean to enter the surf with a sense of solidarity and trust in the wave that God set in motion as essentially good. And then to seek to participate in them. And I think in the final analysis, it's not a cop-out at all, but it's a heck of a lot riskier than designing your own little basket and trying to...
But it seems to me to be a lot less riskier, and we would be less vulnerable if our faith was stronger. Not that we wouldn't change, mm-hmm. but we wouldn't drastically change either, I don't think.
I don't know how much one would change.
An atheist or an agnostic.
You what?
If you are witnessing to an atheist or agnostic, and if you are faithful, use your word, I doubt if the vulnerability will bring you to their side. Although it may open up.
Yeah, I don't think we need to be fearful of that.
No.
You know, but. To be faithful really is to let God, you know, let our relationship to God be also be a piece of that first word open.
Yeah.
you know, open to that. And I think very often that we have a closed stance, even toward God, that we make him too small, you know. And we box him in, and then we try to pass him out like calling cards. Did somebody, you have a comment?
She said, or tracks.
Or tracks, yeah.
Or tracks.
Yeah. Okay, the sixth word, the last one I've got, maybe you've got some we could add to the list, is the word peaceful. The stance is peaceful. This in the sense of shalom. And this refers to a way of life. Peace is the way. The word shalom can refer to the interdependence of things that we've been talking about the last couple of days. It refers to justice, to security, and I believe it's a word that's inclusive in nature. Includes all. Includes all. For me, the word shalom brings to mind my own needs for connectedness with others who will struggle with me in the process of living it out. And I'm not sure this isn't a Shramism. Check it with me, John. But the biblical vision of shalom functions always as a firm rejection of values and lifestyles which seek security and well-being in manipulative ways at the expense of another part of creation, another part of community, or another brother or sister. Was back to where we were earlier today when we talked about the imbalances and the foreign bodies.
And that's the meaning of shalom to you, or to...
Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
that last sentence?
Yeah, what shalom means.
The biblical vision of shalom functions always as a firm rejection of values and lifestyles, the rejection of values and lifestyles, which seeks security and well-being in manipulative ways at the expense of another part of creation, rip off the earth or a person or, you know, what, another part of the community, human community, or another brother or sister.
There's our social norm.
Yeah, there you are again. John, you want to add to that? You've done a lot of work on shalom.
Yeah, I guess the most startling thing in studying the biblical word, because, and I'm, some of you have been to a study that we've done on shalom, since we get our word peace from the Latin word pax, we tend to have the idea that peace in the Bible means the absence of conflict or tranquility or calmness. And if you look it up in the dictionary, that's the first thing it means. If you take the, this is from a word book of the Bible, if you take 350 places where shalom or irene, the New Testament Greek word for peace, are used, personal calmness and tranquility. Instead of that, it is a wholeness, a justice word, a social concept, communal in nature. So when Yoder would say we're not Jewish enough, that would be one of the things we brought, that individual kind of tranquility, which was not the Old Testament concept of shalom.
Okay, let me say the words again to you that describe the stance for me. That's possible. And you may have some words. I'll give you a chance to throw them in here in just a second. Let me review them for you real quick. One is open. Two is visionary. Three was sensitive. Four was vulnerable. Five was faithful. And six, the last one I had, was peaceful. Now, and again, understand the problem, I think, that, let me say it this way. So often, I've been on so many kinds of social concern issues, orientations, study sessions, all that kind of stuff. After we've done it, there's always a tendency to sit down for the last 2 hours and have a strategy session, you know, to work out now how are we going to fix it, kind of an approach. And maybe that's been good for us in a lot of ways. I don't want to put that down. But I think we're moving to a time where there's a broad realization that we really aren't the fixers, we're now participants in something. And how do we do that? And strategy sessions usually have, we have cause and effect kinds of things. We'll do that and that'll happen, that we'll finally control that outcome. Talk to a guy like Jim Couch in Ohio. You know, he works hard on electing the right official, and by golly, he finally gets the guy in, spends 6 months doing it into office, and the guy does a political payoff. On the other hand, he's worse off than he was before he started, and he has strategies coming out of here. Jim said, you know, there's something else got to be working. And so this may be, you know, just words like this, this way of coming at something that we're not, we don't know all we need to know about yet, and we need to know a lot more before we can even, is a way of, not a series of related events, but a way of, you know, with the broader view. So that I wanted to list the words simply to give you an idea, not so much that they're the best words to use to describe what stance could be like, but to give you an idea of maybe a way of dealing, you know, with the kind of stuff I've dumped on you in the last 2 days. And you got any other words you think might be descriptive? Something more fun? Yeah. You know, the one piece that always seems to be missing is joy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I said that about myself not too long ago. I said, you know, not enough joy in my life. I used to tell stories by the hour, jokes. Man, I used to know a thousand of them, you know. And I found out I wasn't telling many anymore, you know. I wasn't laughing as much. And funny. That's kind of funny. Yeah, maybe joyful, you know, and then we ought to talk about.
I don't think that's flippant or just.
No.
I think that's a real.
No.
Yeah.
That's really a heavy.
You don't find that word in peaceful?
Yes. Yes. But to say that, I just think it's worth adding it. Sure, it's in lots of those, but I'm not sure it isn't important to finally not have something so comprehensive that you don't have to break it out other pieces. Sure, it's part of peaceful.
Yeah, a lot could be said about joyful. You know, even the ability, the humor in being able to laugh at how far we miss it. You know, in all our seriousness about all the stuff we've been talking about, you know, ominous forebodings and all that sort of stuff, in the midst of that.
Yeah, because like you said, something's going on and it's in motion, and
yeah,
whether we do anything or not, you know, it's going to happen.
Yeah. So how can there be joy in the midst of that?
So you just shot 3 hours, you could be down the pot shop.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks for coming back for more talk.